Our scripture reading this evening comes from Exodus chapter 2, verses 11 through the end of the chapter. Exodus 2, verses 11 through the end of the chapter. We have been introduced to Moses as a baby. He has been saved in order that he might save. And now we are introduced to Moses as the man. And the first actions that we read of are as follows. Hear now God's holy word. Now it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that way. And when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your companion?" Then he said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you kill the Egyptian?" So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priests of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that you have come so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock." So he said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." Then Moses was content to live with the man. And he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses, and she bore him a son. He called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. May the Lord bless this reading of his word. In many countries, as we know from news reports and the reports of missionaries and even the testimonies of Christians themselves, in many countries, to convert from Islam to Christianity involves, at the very least, so often, being rejected and despised by your community, your own family, your friends, your co-workers. It means also, often in these countries, that you are imprisoned, and sometimes even that you are killed, stoned to death, for that conversion, for that change. When a person who lives in such a society knows that this is a case, why would a person ever convert to Christianity knowing that this is what would face them? And the answer is, of course, it's because God converts them. It's because God has grace upon them. God is the one who changes them. And when God changes the heart of a Muslim into the heart of a Christian, that new heart, that heart of flesh, that spirit-indwelt heart recognizes the worth of Christ and embraces Christ and says, in effect, that he is willing to forsake all else if he but follow Christ. And that is really what we find here in the passage before us with regard to Moses. Moses grew up in the palace of Egypt. There was no greater place at the time, no more sophisticated education, no more powerful and wealthy nation. He grew up in privilege. He grew up in the height of the worldly pleasures of that could be offered to him. Yet, you see, he forsook it all in order to identify himself with the Hebrews and with God. That is one of the primary purposes of this passage, in fact. If you turn over to Hebrews chapter 11, verses 24 through 27, that is exactly the point that is drawn from the passage that we have just read. Notice what the writer of Hebrews says about Moses and his faith. Verse 24, "By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible." So that here, the passage before us demonstrates to us quite clearly that Moses is willing to lose his life in order to gain it. But even more so, we could say that he is willing to lose his life in order to save not only his life, but to be the savior or the deliverer of God's people. And so we see that theme in the passage before us. With that theme in mind, therefore, let us divide the passage into these following 3 points. First, verses 11 through 15, we see Moses' violent loyalty and Pharaoh's animosity. And we can add Israel and Pharaoh's animosity. The second point, verses 16 through 22, Moses' humble help and God's care. And then finally, verses 23 through 25, Israel's painful groan and God's covenant remembrance. And so we begin with Moses' violent loyalty. Loyalty to the Hebrews, loyalty to his God. In verse 11, we are suddenly introduced to Moses as an adult. He is 40 years old at this time when he is moved in his heart to go out and look upon the Hebrews. We skip, in essence, his entire childhood and his entire days of growing up and are placed simply at the time when he begins to act as the deliverer of God's people, much like what happened with Christ. We have very few details about the childhood of Christ, about the days before he enters into the scene of his public ministry. And likewise here with Moses. The thing that's important, therefore, with Christ and with Moses is to see what his actions are at this point, what his public ministry is like, what he as the mature deliverer has become. This is his first, therefore, significant action as presented to us as the deliverer of God's people. Now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. You see how the verse makes it so clear that he identifies with the Hebrews. They are his brethren. He has lived for 4 decades, essentially, in the palace of Egypt as the adopted son of the princess of the Pharaoh. But he casts all that aside and would not be identified with the Egyptians. He casts all those pleasures, all those privileges, all those benefits aside and says, in effect, "No, but I am a Hebrew and I am identified with God's people. They are my brethren." And he has concern for his brethren, for those of his family, for those who belong to his God as well. And that concern leads him to go out and to look at their burdens. And they do have great burdens. And it's no mistake that the very first thing we read that he is seeing here is this burden: an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. That word for beating is literally striking. In fact, it's the same word that's used when Moses kills the Egyptian. Moses struck him. And so we see this Egyptian striking the Hebrew. This is not a light beating. This is not ruffling him up in any way. This is a serious matter. He is likely to die if Moses does not intervene. And so Moses intervenes, and he kills this Egyptian. Now, this clearly shows us with violence, in fact, how much he identifies with God's people. But is this right? If you were a prosecuting attorney, you likely would delight to receive such a case as this. If you looked only at Exodus 2, you could say that this man was premeditated in his action. He looked this way and that way before he acted. That this man covered up his crime. He buried the Egyptian. That's a sign of guilt, surely. And finally, you could say there are witnesses to this crime, at least one, who is willing to spread the matter about, who is willing to testify of what Moses did. It is a dream case for a prosecuting attorney. Premeditation, covering up, witnesses. It's open and shut. It's an obvious case, isn't it? It seems that way. But notice, when we turn to the book of Acts, Acts chapter 7, and we read here of this sermon that Stephen gave about this event, He gives it a rather different flavor, doesn't he? Verse 23 of Acts chapter 7, this is how Stephen describes this event. Now, when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. And then if you jump down to verse 35, notice that Moses is not right in understanding himself to be the deliverer that God has sent. Verse 35, this Moses whom they rejected, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge?" That's the exact quote from our passage. "Is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush." In other words, Moses has come, according to Stephen, to act as a deliverer. This is an act of defense. He's defending the life of one of his brethren. And he is avenging the wrong that was done to him. Does he have the right to do so? Well, he is clearly appointed by God to be a deliverer. There is cause, therefore, to wonder whether he went too far or not. But the main point of this passage is not to figure out exactly how this trial would end, but rather to recognize what Stephen is making clear in his sermon throughout. That God's people have a deliverer raised up for them, a zealous deliverer, and they reject him. That's in fact the point of the entire sermon in Acts 7. God raises up someone to deliver, to help them, and they despise and reject him. All along the line, Moses is included to the point where Christ comes. And so he says, the entire time you've been rejecting these legitimate men that God has raised up. It is little wonder, therefore, that you reject Christ. And so above all, we see here whether Moses went too far, whether he was rash, whether he should not have done this or not. We see here the zeal of Moses to identify with and to defend and deliver his people, as God had appointed him to do. And how then do they respond to him? Notice, then the second day he went out. Now, this time in verse 13, he beheld two Hebrew men fighting. They were wrestling, they were grappling with one another. And they said to the one who did the wrong, and there's obviously one who is doing wrong as opposed to the other who is innocent, "Why are you striking your companion?" In other words, it's exactly the same scenario. One is striking the companion wrongly. One is acting as an evildoer against the innocent victim. But Moses treats it very differently, doesn't he? He doesn't look this way or that way and avenge this wrong, but rather he deals with them as brethren. And so he asks them, "Why are you doing this? Do you not have enough violence from those who oppress us outside? Do you not have enough affliction from those who hate us? Why, within this group of brethren, Why are you fighting amongst yourselves? The question, no doubt, that we as Christians have cause to ask ourselves from time to time. Why would we fight ever with one another? Don't we have enough pressure from the outside world? Don't we have enough affliction from those who hate us as God's people? Why would we ever bicker or fight with each other? That's what he's saying. That's what Moses is saying to these brethren. How could you strike one another? Don't you suffer enough from the hands of evildoers outside of the brethren? But notice the answer then of the evildoer, the one who is doing wrong. In verse 14, it's very sharp. It's a rejection of Moses. Who made you a prince and judge over us? Well, if you really wanted an answer, the answer is God. We read that from Stephen's account in Acts 7. Who made you a judge and ruler? God did. God is the one who is raising up Moses to be a deliverer. The second question, do you intend to kill me as you kill the Egyptian? The answer, if he wants it, is no, of course not. He's one of the brethren. He did not come to kill the Israelites, but to save them. He did not come to make their lives worse, more violent, more miserable, but to deliver them. The man, however, rejects Moses clearly and responds to him very sharply. That's what Stephen says, isn't it? Here is the deliverer God has raised up, and they reject him. And in the process of rejecting him, of course, this Israelite who is doing the wrong makes clear that the business of killing the Egyptian is known. And because it is known now, Moses, fearful of what will happen, must flee. In other words, he's a man who is rejected and despised by men. All men. His own brethren and the Egyptians as well. The world and the church, if you like. He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with griefs. That's what we find here with regard to Moses, the deliverer that God has raised up. And so, he is right, of course, in verse 15. When Pharaoh heard of the matter, he sought to kill Moses. Moses' position in the court, in the royal family, Moses' privilege has no bearing upon the case. The Pharaoh says that if you identify with the Hebrews against the Egyptians, you are a traitor and you will die. Very much like, as we have said, Muslims who become Christians, their position, their connections, anything that preceded that conversion make no difference so often. They are treated as those who are deserving of punishment. So that's what we see here. He's rejected by everyone. And consequently, he flees to Midian. This brings us to our second point, Moses' humble help and God's care. This point opens then by asking, why did Moses flee to Midian? In Genesis 25, verses 1 through 2, we learn that Midian was a son of Abraham by Keturah. You remember that when Sarah died, Abraham remarried, and he remarried a woman named Keturah, and one of their children was Midian. And so Moses is fleeing here to Abrahamic descendants. He is fleeing to, as close as possible, those who are connected to Abraham. They would have a rather similar culture, language, and so forth. But they are very different in this sense. They are not the true people of God. We find, in fact, that the man he meets there, Reuel, is, in fact, a priest, a pagan priest. It is not until Exodus 18 that this man, also known as Jethro, this man suddenly recognizes that God alone is God. Up to this point, he serves a panoply of idols and of various false gods. And so Moses is fleeing to pagans, though they have perhaps a flavor of the culture he's used to. He is fleeing to people who do not serve God, who are not God's people. In fact, it is a Midianite woman later on in the book of Numbers who is brought into the camp by a Levite with the result that God raised up one of the priests to put a javelin through them. The Midianites were not known to be, therefore, God's people were faithful to God in the least, but they were Abrahamic descendants. And so he fled there with the hope of at least escaping from the immediate danger. And as he flees there, he sat down by a well. A well was a common place of meeting. It was a place where he might expect to have people come and he might find some sort of help there. Where else will he go? What else will he do? He has no friends that we know of. He is a stranger here. And so he sits by the well and wonders, no doubt, what will happen next, what will come, and certainly we do. And what comes next is the seven daughters of this priest. And they are watering the flock. They are filling the troughs for the flock to drink. And because they are all daughters, they are women, they are weaker than the shepherds, and the shepherds are taking advantage of them, driving them away. And what does Moses do? A stranger. He doesn't have any connections, he doesn't have any support. He doesn't have any influence or power as he might have in Egypt. What does he do? He shows that he has not given up. He is still a man whose character is that of a deliverer. He cannot sit still and watch this happen. He cannot simply sit there and do nothing about it. Whenever he sees the weak being taken advantage of, being oppressed, he must rise up and act. That's the character God has given him. That's what will serve him well in the future when he goes to deliver God's people. And so he simply acts according to the godly character that he has. He rises up and he helps them. He drives away the shepherds. He saves them from them as they themselves testify. And then he goes above and beyond and draws water for them as well. He's serving them. That's the man God has raised up. And because of this action, he is given a temporary home. God cares for him. You see, how often when we are simply going about and doing the normal, everyday, godly things that he calls us to do, does he use those actions, does he use that character to solve the immediate problems before us? How often have you experienced this? You have something on your mind. You're wondering how it will come to resolution. You are concerned about it. But before you take any action specifically with regard to it, simply because you are doing what God says, he makes provision for you. Well, that's the case here with Moses. He shows the character of a deliverer, of a godly man. And in a day and age in which we read accounts of those who are mugged, who are cut, who are bleeding in the street, and people walking by and doing nothing to help them. In fact, it's nothing new, is it? You remember the parable of the Good Samaritan? That's exactly what happened. People walked by as someone bled and almost died in the streets. In a day and age in which we recognize this is the character of man, they don't want to get involved, they don't want to help, they'd rather walk by. Here is Moses, the godly deliverer and the character of a man of God on display for us. He gets involved. He helps. And so it is that when these daughters return to their father in verse 18, and he is surprised that they've come back so soon, Moses truly did help them, and that help facilitated a quick return to their father. That they reported in verse 19 that an Egyptian delivered them. Of course, Moses would look very much like an Egyptian, having grown up for 40 years in the Egyptian palace. And so they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hands of the shepherds and watered the flock. And of course, this father is disconcerted with his daughters. Well, where is he? If he helped you, why aren't you thanking him properly? And so they go and they bring the man to his house, and God provides for him there. He's content to live with the man, and even to marry his daughter, Zipporah, and even to have a son by her. There is then this caring for Moses in exile. There is this watching over him. There is the love of God that is demonstrated in this temporary abode that he has, in this temporary refuge that he has. But you see here his heart is still with God's people. You see here that he still has his mind fixed upon what is happening in Egypt. His heart is still bound up with his people there. We see this especially in the fact that he names his first son Gershom. Gershom comes from a combination of Hebrew words, ger meaning stranger, and sham meaning there. And so he says, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. There's some debate over what this means, but when he says, I have been a stranger, that is the literal Hebrew, I have been a stranger, speaking of a past experience. And when he says, a stranger there instead of here, he's speaking of his experience in Egypt. He's thinking about how he was a stranger in Egypt. He is, as it were, groaning about his experience there. And since his mind is bound up with that hardship and he's thinking about what happened there and he's remembering and he's experiencing that hardship anew, as it were, naming his son, he is adding his own groan to the groans of those who remain in Egypt. Which brings us to our third point. Israel's painful groan in God's covenant remembrance. He is groaning as he remembers his experience in Egypt. And they also, in verse 23, are groaning. And here's how it begins. It happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry came up to God because of the bondage. This is the same king that Moses fled from. This is likely the same king that gave the edict that the sons of the Hebrews were to be put to death. And when he dies, it's significant for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is, as a later chapter in Exodus will make clear, now Moses is somewhat free to return to Egypt. In the same way that you recall the Lord told Joseph and Mary that they were able to go back into Israel because the leader who sought their death had died. And so likewise here, God is opening the door for Moses to be able to return to Egypt. He is beginning to prepare the path for the Redeemer, for the Deliverer, to return to Egypt. But more importantly here in this context, the people of Israel received no change in their status. They received no relief from the sufferings. Perhaps they'd hoped that. No doubt they'd hoped that. They had longed for the possibility that when this king who began to murder their little children died, there would be some relief. There would be some loosening of the hatred, some loosening of these afflictive policies against them. But if so, they found no relief. When he died, the plan continued, and then they really began to groan in their bondage to the Lord. And they did groan to the Lord. It's not made explicit here in this passage, but in Deuteronomy 26:7, that's made quite explicit. That they're groaning to the Lord their God. That they're crying out to Him. And that's always what happens, or should happen, isn't it? When there's some affliction or trial or difficulty, we are being pressed and squeezed to go to the Lord. To make our cares known to the Lord. To cast our burdens on the Lord. We know this from our experience that even unbelievers go to the Lord in their trials. How many in war, how many soldiers have cried out to God in the heat of the battle? How many neighbors who are completely unbelieving neighbors have come to you in time of need and asked for prayer? How much more when God's own people are in trials and difficulties do they come and cry out to the Lord in their need? And that's exactly what is happening here. And that's exactly what God intended through the sufferings. The Lord, as you recall previously in Genesis 15 especially, very clearly showed that He had a time frame. After 400 years, He would come and deliver His people. After 400 years would be the time when He would move, when He'd take action. That time has come. And therefore His people, as He presses and pushes them, are beginning to cry out to Him in their bondage. And of course, since He is the one moving them to this, He will hear them. Verse 24, so God heard their groaning, and God remembered His covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. God heard them, obviously, as we have said, but It's interesting that he remembered his covenant. Doesn't that strike you as odd? God remembering? Can God forget something? Isn't God, by very definition, one who knows all things at once and always? The one who is thoroughly acquainted with everything at all times. Nothing escapes his notice or glance. Nothing is lost upon him. He's not weak. He doesn't have a relapse of memory and so forth. No, none of these things. By very definition, as God, he cannot forget. He always knows. So when the scriptures use this terminology and represent him as remembering, it is especially to note that he is bringing the matter, as it were, to the forefront of his mind in order to take action. That's what we do when we remember, isn't it? Or should do. Oh, I forgot to send that email. Let me do it now as I remember it. And so it is with the Lord. He's represented as remembering his covenant now and being ready to take action. He promised to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob that he would be their God, that he'd be with them, that he'd bring them out of the land, that he'd bring them to the promised land. He had pledged himself in this way. Now he remembers it has come to the forefront, and he's about to take action. And what is it that moves him to action? It's prayer. It's prayer that brings him to remembrance upon these promises and makes him ready to act. But how does praying to God then fit with the sovereignty of God? But it fits perfectly, doesn't it? Because who is the one moving them to prayer? Who is the one who says, it's time for me to act now? As I have predicted, the time has come, and I'm moving my people to pray, and therefore I will answer. God's behind their prayers. There's one thing that church historians have noted about revivals, true revivals, that is significant in regard to this question. They have said, many of them, that one of the wonders of revival is this, that suddenly, not because of any plan of men, not because of any schedule drawn up where people sign up and so forth, but simply they realize that before revival, throughout the land or throughout the area, people in churches began to pray for it, spontaneously, but universally, fervently, but without any sort of outward constraints or plans of men. Because the Lord, you see, was saying, it's time for revival. And therefore, his people were praying for it. That's how God works. God says, it's time for me to act. And therefore, he moves his people to pray. And that's what's happening here. It's time for him to act. And therefore, his people are groaning out to him. The very groans and prayers that he is pushing them to. And therefore, God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. Literally, God knew. God knew. We know, of course, in the scriptures that knowing is not simply, or not always at least, simply an intellectual perception or grasp of something. It could be a very personal, intimate term. We know, of course, that in Genesis, this refers to the marriage between Adam and Eve. Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore a child. When God knows his people, it speaks of a deep and intimate, a personal relationship or bond with them. When God looked upon his people and he knew them, it means that he had an intimate, loving, deep, profound bond with them. Surely when God looks upon his people in this way, redemption, deliverance, help is not far off. And that's the point. By their prayers, we have not because we have not asked, that God was working through them according to his timing and his intimate, tender love and care towards them. They are about to be delivered. And it is through the hand of Moses whom God has given the character of a deliverer. Well, as we consider this, let us simply note this once more. Let us simply recognize that Moses has given up all of the glory, all of the privilege, all of the exaltation that he enjoyed in the court of Pharaoh in order to be identified with, to suffer for, and to deliver his brethren. Well, that's Christ, isn't it? Christ was exalted in heaven. Christ was as glorious as the Father. He shared the glory with the Father. He was God and is God, of course, but was God in terms of his manifest glory. There is no humiliation. There's no suffering. But he gave that up. He clothed it in flesh that he might redeem us. He came down and identified himself with mankind and particularly with his brethren. He is not ashamed to call us brethren. And he was a deliverer who shed his blood that his people might be saved. That speaks of the intimate, personal, loving bond that God has with his people so that he would deliver them from their sins. And that is what we see in the life of Moses as it begins this pursuit of deliverance. Let's pray.